I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope, gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Brian Reed of the University of Washington, Seattle, whose new book is Phenomenal Reading, Essays on Modern and Contemporary Poetics, published by Alabama. A man of many projects, including a forthcoming book on 21st century avant-garde poetics called Nobody's Business, published, Brian, by Cornell, yes, or forthcoming, whose interests as writer and teacher include international modernism, the avant-garde, experimental fiction, electronic literature, New York of the 50s, it's a favorite topic of mine, and art music from John Cage onwards. Was there art music before John Cage? That's another question. And by Maria Damon, coming to us from Minnesota, whose books include, and this is a random list, Maria, Pleasure Text Possession, Literature Nation, Writing, Social Science, and Ethnicity and Gertrude Stein. And is that a book you wrote?
No, that's the subtitle of an article I wrote.
I love the subtitle. How about Jazz, Jews, Jive, and Gender?
That's the title of an article I wrote.
And Dark End of the Street is
a book,
and it is maybe your first book.
Yes.
Fantastic. I did pretty well with that intro, and whose many articles, including several I already mentioned, include an important one on Bob Kaufman, which influenced me very much, and who very seriously weaves. Yes.
And cross-stitches.
And cross-stitches. Whatever those mean, I'm sure they're significant. And by Craig Dworkin, whose Eclipse archive is completely crucial, including facsimiles and other digital recordings of out-of-print and hard-to-find experimental work, including 16 works by Clark Coolidge, as I counted this morning, Kenneth Goldsmith's Traffic, and Bruce Andrews' A Cappella, to name just a few, who with Goldsmith is the editor of Against Expression, an anthology of conceptual writing, and whose many other works include Parse, a rewriting of Edwin Abbott's 1874 grammar book, How to Parse, parsed itself according to its own weird system. So it's not easy to summarize that book quickly, but I tried. Hey, Brian, congratulations on the new book. Welcome to the Writer's House.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Is this your first time at the Writer's House?
Nope. I was here once before for a Hart Crane-related event.
Fantastic. Welcome back. And Maria, good to see you again.
Oh, likewise.
Tell me more about weaving.
Well, it's very soothing. I will be talking about that. Well, mostly I'll be talking about cross-stitching and other things that happen on a very simplistic grid later on today.
In a talk that we will, by the time this Poem Talk is released, we will have that somewhere in audio and video on the web somewhere, maybe in Penn Sound. And Craig, hi. How's your talk?
Hi, Al. Good to be here.
Good 3 a.m. arrival. You're going to be really jazzy this morning.
Yeah, this is poem listening for me, I think. Okay. Maybe more than
welcome.
Talking.
Oh, you stole my strategy.
Welcome, all three of you. Today, we've gathered here to talk about the aforementioned Clark Coolidge, a poem by Coolidge called Blues for Alice, published in Sound as Thought Poems 1982-84. Penn Sound's recording of Coolidge performing the poem comes from a reading he did at the Tyler School of Art at Temple University on April 10th, 1985, a recording made by Rachel Blau Duplessis. So here now is Clark Coolidge performing Blues for Alice.
This is called Blues for Alice. When you get it on a try, you never learn it back. Umpteen times the tenth part of a featured world, in black and in back its roses and fostered nail bite rhyme sling slang, a song that teaches without travail of the tale, the one you longing live and singing burn. It's insane to remain a trope of a rinsing out or a ringing, whatever, it's those bells that and other riskier small day and fain would be of the soap a sky dares, but we remand, that we a clasp of the silence, you and I, all of tiny sphering rates back, I say to told wall, back and leave my edge and add an L. Night is so enclosed, will never turn its page, its eye can be mine, will be yours, to see all the people, the underneath livid reaching part and past of the lying buildings that the overreacher stops and starts, at in his head, in her rhythm, that knowledge is past all of us, so so we flare and tap and top it right up, constant engage and flap in on, keeping pace, our whelming rift and soil and gleam, and give back the voice like those eerie dead. Step down off our whelm lessons and shortly fired enter the bristle strum of corrosion kingdom, where the last comes by first every ring, every race through that tunnel of sun drop and pencil in margins of a flare, of higher wish than dare, the stroked calmings of a line will spin and chime in blue quicks of a dream blues, the chores of those whispering gone crenulations. To meet a care is to dial redeem, and we limp in the time sound bombs. So out of kilter is my name in the sun, and I win in the moon, and you sing in that other spelling of win, the way a blue is never singular.
How crucial is the Charlie Parker Blues for Alice, the song, the classic, the standard? Is it important? Brian, what's your thought on that? Is it something a reader is very much helped by knowing?
I think that, as often happens with poetry that references jazz, it's not so much that you can sit down with, say, the time signature of the original piece and then map it onto the poem. It's more that it invokes an entire sort of set of assumptions and questions about how music works. In this case, the word blues alone is enough to summon up an entire sort of world of how one thinks about or responds to music. And so by knowing specifically that there's a Charlie Parker reference, one begins thinking about bebop, how, where that historically fits into the history of jazz. And all these things prepare you for or provide an envelope for the poem. I think that's how I would begin to think.
How about a little more specifically bebop?
Bebop.
Does that help?
Yes. Bebop as a form of jazz performance that emphasizes free performance, but also a group, usually a quartet or a quintet, in which each instrument takes turns soloing. So this sense of now is the time for this voice to improvise, to begin, to explore, to riff on some kind of musical standard.
Does that mean, Craig or Maria, that we have one voice leading to another doing solos? What's the concept of voice in this poem, either of you?
I don't know about voice, but I do think that Blues for Alice might be even more specifically important in the sense of the work is a touchstone for complexity and alacrity and alteration, the incredibly fast chord changes, whether 18 or 20 chord changes in the 12 bars of that blues, and that there maybe is a way into thinking about how the phrases here are shifting very quickly, even before you're, you know, to the end of what would seem to be a complete
So when
thought.
I asked that, I was thinking of, I'm sorry to interrupt, when I asked that, I was thinking of voice in the way we sometimes mean it, often badly, to identify a stable subject or subject that gives way to another one. Voice as in, I found my voice. But I also meant it literally as Clark Coolidge means it when he's obsessed with the actual voice of, for instance, Jack Kerouac. Is that sense of voice important here? I mean, we just listened to this remarkable voice. Though it's not, I mean, I'll just say before I turn to you, Maria, on this, that Blues for Alice, Charlie Parker's, at least most of the performances I've heard, are, you know, rapid bebop, blues-style chord voicings. This is not rapid. It feels rapid in the way that it does the what do we call that in Kerouac, that the kind of flow of, what, babble
tempo.
Flow, the babble
yeah.
flow, the babble flow. But anyway, what your thought on this, Maria?
Well, in thinking about bebop, I tend to think about humor. The whimsy, the wordplay, the nonsense element, and the sort of knowing invocation of banalities in order to transform them. And I see that here a great deal, obviously, with a lot of the wordplay and the apokoinus. You know, you think the end of one phrase becomes the beginning of another. So there's that also that forward propulsion that you hear and that, you know, you're referring to as the speed even though he's reading slowly, there's a forward propulsion that's pushing the poem further along and also deeper, I think, layer after layer with each pun or with each turn or with each off rhyme or, you know.
I don't think we're going to do any kind of semantic close reading of this poem because we're interested, although I you can tell I was about to try to get us to do it, because clearly what's happening here is music or sound as thought, I suppose. But can we just try to do, I'll pick a line or two, a song that teaches without travail of the tale. That means something to me. And also the first line, when you get it on a try, mm-hmm. you never learn it back, umpteen times the tenth part. What's that first line mean, Craig Dworkin, in some old sense of mean?
Well, I think part of what it means is about maybe the distinction or the conflation, I'm not sure here, between something like pedagogy and pedantry, that it's a line that is, you know, about learning, and so it picks up then on all of these other pedagogic terms, teaching, knowledge, lessons, step down off our whelm lessons, but then it's also in that syntactic phrase of an adage. It's the phrasing of what of avuncular wisdom or the lessons of experience. And I think that ties, that ties actually right back into why Parker's important here with Coolidge's association, which was a clear association of Kerouac with Parker. Apparently, Kerouac listened primarily to Charlie Parker and the end of Mexico City blues or these elegies to Parker, and for Kerouac, that's a question of it's a question of pedagogy. He talks about how he couldn't imagine being a writer with what he calls the whole pedantic notion, that you know what you're going to say, and then you find the right word for it.
Nice.
But then when he read Kerouac, he thought, this guy doesn't know where he's going. He's improvising. He's winging it. And so improvisation, when you get it on a try, this thing that you cannot learn back, that improv is somehow opposed to
pedagogy. I want to turn to Brian as a follow-up to this, but I just want to throw in Clark Coolidge's favorite statement by Blanchot, Maurice Blanchot, as follows, quote, this is from Blanchot, his favorite, one can only write if one arrives at the instant toward which one can only move through space opened up by the movement of writing. I think that sort of follows from what you were just saying. Brian, thoughts on this at all?
I absolutely think that the first line is about improvisation, but it's also about how you have the perfect take. That you do it and
get
you get it
on
right.
First try.
Or if it's the third try and it's the perfect one, then no matter how much you study, how much you try to replicate through careful study, that wonderful, perfect instant, you're not going to get there.
Nice. So what about the song that teaches without travail the tale? I guess that's the same thing, huh?
Well, I think it's playing off against the Poundian idea that the real poem is a tale of the tribe. But this is a tale without travail. You don't need to go through all that suffering. You can play it out, spin it out. The end of that, before the break, is the word burn. And then after the next several lines, there's a break in a white space, and it's dares. And then the word flare is going to come back. This is about the kind of incandescence of the perfect performance.
Does he pull it off?
Pyrotechnics, yeah.
Do you think he pulls it off? I mean, partly this is an analogy to what's so great about jazz. He refers elsewhere to Kerouac as having a magic voice in this sense. But does the magic voice work in this poem? Does he pull off the analogy, do you think, Maria?
Oh, I certainly think he does. I just want to go back to the first line and then the song that teaches without travail of the tale. The first line made me think of Miles Davis saying, don't fear mistakes, there are none. You just keep going and going and, you know, that's the way it goes.
Or Anthony Braxton, right, who talked about improvisation by saying that if you're not making a mistake, you're making a mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about Kerouac for a second. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah,
Maria. Yeah,
I also wanted to sing because we're talking about this poem in terms of its intertextual references, mostly to male sort of huge towering figures.
We're forgetting
of the
about
50s.
Alice.
Well, we're forgetting about all the Alices, and this is what a song that teaches without travail of the tale makes me think of Alice in Wonderland, and the way it is pedagogical without being onerous.
And okay, so there's one Alice.
Yeah, that's any one others? Alice. Yeah, Alice Notley.
Alice Notley.
Alice
and
Coltrane.
Brian discovered somehow on a manuscript or a typescript of this poem that was autographed. This is a poem for Alice Notley?
Yep. I was going through and Googling, as one does these days, and found an eBay ad for a manuscript of this poem that was had on it written for Alice Notley.
So there's a second Alice. Do you want to make anything of that Alice, Maria? Alice Notley?
Alice Notley?
Connection?
Well, I'm thinking, initially I was thinking about Alice Coltrane. And
yes.
I went
well, there's a third
listen
Alice.
To listen to Alice Coltrane. Then when Brian posted, I think you did post this little treasure that you found about Alice Notley. I thought, oh, well.
You thought that Brian scooped you, as he usually does, but in fact, he was just adding another
that's
Alice.
That's right. And then I was thinking about, well, what do these Alices have in common? They're both very powerful women who were attached to and to some degree eclipsed by their...
Poem Talk listeners will want to know what you're referring to in the Alice Notley context. They may not know. Of this eclipsing.
She was the partner of Ted Berrigan, who was a kind of a major figure, mentor figure and central figure in second generation New York school. And I would say that it's only in the last couple decades that she's really come into her own as someone that the world acknowledges as a major.
And would
major
that be
writer.
True of Alice Coltrane as well? That may have been a leading question.
I would say yes. I mean, she took a spiritual path and founded an ashram and took a different name and stopped performing publicly for
and
many
Parker's
years.
Parker's poem, the one we're talking... I'm sorry, Parker's song, the one that's being acknowledged here, is that Alice is Alice Coltrane?
I don't know.
Does anybody know?
I tried to find out and couldn't find a specific reference.
But one could suppose it might be. So both of these women are extremely powerful, charismatic figures in their own right. But
so does this jazz pedagogy, is it liberationist in that it's seeking to recuperate the Alices? Or am I making that too poem talky easy?
I think it is trying to set up some kind of dialogue, or at least call and response. There are the lines about at in his head, in her rhythm, where you're having a him and a her brought together. And insofar, if this is for Alice Notley,
yeah.
You have two New York-based, or poets associated with New York, even if Notley later moves to Paris, but a sense of peers, mm-hmm. one writing a poem for another, like Jackson McClough's Endless Poems for Somebody, also a New York way poet. So that, by bringing it between two poets and peers, I think... is an acknowledgement, is an invitation for a return poem, I suppose.
At in his head, in her rhythm, that knowledge is past all of us, so we flare and tap and top it right up, constant engage and flap in on, keeping pace, our whelming rift and soil and gleam, and give back the voice like those eerie dead.
Tell us about Sound as Thought. It's the title of the collection, Poems 1982-84. Coolidge goes to Tyler, the Tyler School of Art, to give this fabulous performance in 1985, a few years later. He reads a series of Sound as Thought poems. Anybody want to, now that I stalled a little bit there, to give you a chance to think about it, what does Sound as Thought mean in this context? Craig, you've thought a lot about Sound as Thought lately, haven't you?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean I'm going to give you a good answer here.
Give it a try. You're a genius.
Part of what it means for me here, and part of what struck me as interesting about this poem, is that it seems like it's not just Sound as Thought. That you get several tracks running simultaneously, but not but overlapping. So sometimes you're going by the phrase. Sometimes you're going by. You know, some more conventional reference, and sometimes you're following the sound as if the sound were making meaningful connection. So back and back and leave my edge and add an L, which gives you ledge, and there are all of the architectural parts of walls and roofing and buildings here, but that's then also the ledge of knowledge, but then it's also the ledge of Coolidge, and with the signature that that comes in at the end, where out of kilter is my name in the sun. If you're a cool ledge, you're out of kilter in the hot sun.
Come so, on, you just made that up right there. I'm teasing you. You said you had but nothing to say, and then you did this great thing, Craig.
I'm following the sound.
I think I'd like to hang out with you every time you haven't had any sleep.
But, I mean, you could build on that. The L is a capital L that comes before a white space. You crawl out on the bar of the L and then leap. I mean, the poem invites this kind of reading because it sets us up for it.
Well, plus L effect comes back with the move, and this is another sound move, from I to lying. Night is so enclosed, we'll never turn its page, it's I. And then the next line, you get to those lying buildings.
So how important...
There's an L in Alice, too.
Mm-hmm. Maria, let's start with you. How important do you think Coolidge is in the, you know, how important to us, those of us who think about sound, poetry as sound, contemporary poetry as sound. Where does he fit, if there's a fitting here? And if you don't like that question, answer this one. How can sound be thought?
Well, sound as thought brings to my mind body and soul, a kind of, you know, jazz standard, I think, played upon by John Coltrane.
So it's the erasing of an old binarism.
Well, it's a playing with the binarism in a way that makes it interesting, and not only, on the one hand, it erases it, but it erases it through embroidery, through improvisation.
I knew you were going to say embroidery.
Well, that just came to mind. But I think that, you know, I was thinking, I'm still hung up on the one you longing live and singing burn with regard to Alice Notley, because... Because she works a lot at the edge of that sort of liminal threshold between the living and the dead. That's what much of her current work is. I don't know about what she was doing during this period, but the body and soul being partners, but also independently functioning from each other, so that one can pass back and forth.
So if we go from sound as thought to body and soul, and therefore to body as soul, as soul.
And sound is physical, but it's not. It's physical, but it's invisible.
Yeah, it's what he was talking about when he used the phrase magic voice to refer to Kerouac. Let me quote you from Coolidge, writing in American Poetry Review in 1995 about Kerouac's sound. I'll quote it. You guys react any way you want. In Bop, there's actually a sort of ghost of an offbeat, but it's far less prominent. Charlie Parker, he said in this piece about Kerouac, Charlie Parker began to hear longer lines, and Kerouac obviously did too. Brian, is there any particular sense to ghost of an offbeat? Do we have such things?
I'm still trying to figure out ghost of an offbeat, but in terms of longer lines, I think you can hear it. In this poem, the way that he falls into cadences of iambs and anapests, da 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 da, and then he punctuates it so that if the last stanza, to meet a care is to dial redeem, and we limp in the time sound balms, he uses those monosyllables to end those long lines of flow, da 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 da. And in that one, after that, the end is in the moon, and you sing in that other spelling of wind, the way a blue is never singular. So after the kind of lilting iambs and anapests, it ends with a troche and a dactyl, da-da, da-da-da, and you have that kind of falling off, right, again, to punctuate. It's as if there are two really long lines making up that single stanza underlying the lineation that you can see on the page.
What is the other spelling of wind?
The first word of the poem. Right. When you get it on a try.
Does that correspond with a Southwestern accent? Because it certainly isn't a New England.
No, it's Great Midwestern. I can't tell
the difference. This might be my Hoosier roots here.
What about Coolidge's roots?
Well, he's a blue blood from New England, right? So it would be possibly a reference, I was thinking, to the way Alice might speak.
Wow, I'd love that.
I don't know.
Hey, we could riff and just play on this poem for a long time. So why don't we just wrap up artificially by having each of us say one thing that you wanted to say but didn't have a chance. So, Craig Dworkin, what's your final thought on this?
I wanted to go back to what Maria said about humor and just underscore that a lot of this is really funny, like the way a blue is never singular, right? You say, well, I have the blues, but you never say, well, I'm only feeling a little bit bad. I just have the blue today. And that's funny.
Yeah, I would emphasize that a poem that plays with and about improvisation, you expect it to lack structure. But this one turns out to be very carefully plotted in its itinerary. And it's not just that you get win back to win. You get blue is never singular, i.e. blues was the first word. And at the way that dares is repeated, or burn plus dare equals flare, it is a carefully controlled itinerary from beginning to end.
Cool. Maria?
I also wanted to talk about sing and singular.
Yeah.
in terms of these dyads, these guys writing poems or music for Alice, Alice and Ted, Alice and John, and also the idea that the blues is a folk idiom. It's collective and it is not singular. Mm. It's blues is never singular.
Terrific. Nice. My final word is simply to put into the record the quote where I've been getting this phrase, magic voice. This is from Coolidge, writing about Kerouac. He says, I know that voice has been talked about a lot, but I think there are certain writers where what you get is a kind of magic voice. So he's saying, I know we've been talking about voice, but I'm talking about a magic voice. Once you've heard it, he says, you can never read those words again without hearing that voice, even if you don't have a very developed subvocal ability. I think what he means... Go ahead, Marie.
I was going to say, this reminds me of Foucault in What is an Author, and he completely erodes the concept of an author, but then he says, but there are 19th century founders of discourse, Marx, Freud, and Nietzsche. You know, there are those magic voices that change the way we think.
He's saying that about Kerouac, for sure.
Yeah.
I like to think about Kerouac in that Mount Rushmore that mm-hmm. you just... But the point I wanted to make is that this concept of the sub-vocal ability is terrific. And also that Coolidge is writing about Kerouac, but actually I'm feeling today that way about Coolidge.
Gleam and give back the voice like those eerie dead. They're eerie because they come back, but you hear it right in your ear.
Yeah.
There's the magic voice. There's the ghost of the offbeat as well. A lot of ghosts here.
Well, there's the preoccupation with the other world and liminality.
Mm-hmm. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. And who wants to gather some paradise? Brian Reed, do you have something to recommend?
I do. He'll be embarrassed by it, but I recommend Craig Dworkin's book, Smokes, which is from Roof and is an absolutely wonderful book of short poems that you can take in one at a time and puzzle over and really will be a route to paradise.
That's nice. Speaking of that, then, Craig.
Wow, thank you. Not brand new. I think it's maybe 2008 or so, but Fred Moten's book, Hewson's Taverns, kicked my ass like nothing else this decade.
Moten. Great. Thank you. Maria.
Two, if you will. Cecilia Vicuña on Vimeo, What is Poetry to You? And Amaranth Borsuk, Between Page and Screen.
Thank you. Terrific. I'm going to gather some paradise by recommending the 1951 recording of Blues for Alice by Charlie Parker, which features Red Rodney on trumpet, and it is available illegally, on YouTube. So you just have to punch in Blues for Alice Parker and you'll get it. I'm not sure we're going to be able to link it to the program notes to this site because we are scrupulous about permission. And Craig's looking at me thinking, what a fool. You do ask permission whenever you do anything at Eclipse. Am I correct?
Absolutely everything on Eclipse is permission.
I'm shocked. Well, that's all the bite rhyme sling slang we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House of the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Brian Reed, Maria Damon, and Craig Dworkin, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, Chris Martin, and, as always, to our editor, Steve McLaughlin. And a shout-out to Rachel Blau Duplessis for making such a good recording back. Oh, they're applauding you, Rachel. Back in 85 and for permitting us to include it and many others, and many other recordings that Rachel has made in Penn Sound. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.